Hi, it's Bob Lines. I'd like to invite you to a free webinar this Thursday, August 7th, from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And it will include Tammy Flanagan being the star of the show, and she's going to talk about federal benefits. You don't know what you don't know. I'll be the moderator, and we'll take questions online during the show. But she's got some great things to talk about, whether it's TSP withdrawals, things you don't know, things you should. Please, please sign up at NITPINC.com. That's NITPINC.com. Thanks. And now for today's show.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. Well, we're going to talk about taxes, estate planning, the IRS. What's the best thing or things to do? And to lead us in that discussion is Dave DeJong, attorney, and Steve Wittes, attorney. Partners at Stein Sperling, attorneys in Rockville, Maryland. Dave is the chair of the firm's tax practice group, CPA, Masters in Law. And to be frank, if I ever got into a street fight with an IRS agent, I want to be with Dave. Dave and I have known each other a long time, and we learned from the master, and Dave is just great at it. Steve, it's our second time on the show, I believe, and you're the co-chair of the firm's estates and trust practice and works with clients in the areas of estate planning, estate and trust administration, tax, and business succession planning. Wow. I'm going to be listening, guys. So we're going to talk, I guess, about several subjects: wills, revocable trusts, should you hold assets jointly with your spouse and or your children? Should bank and brokerage accounts be set up as payable, transferable on death? Who should your primary and secondary retirement plan beneficiaries be? How do you best protect assets against creditors and predators? I like that. Anyway, we're going to talk about all those, and certainly we'll talk about anything, and I won't say anything, most things tax-related and estate-related. How do I get in touch with you two?
We are both partners at the Rockville, Maryland law firm of Stein Sperling. Our main phone number is 301-340-2020.
Okay. Now, this is me talking. I'm aware that some attorneys like to use a will as a positive instrument of one's estate, and others use a document called a revocable trust. What's the difference, and which one is better?
Well, a will, Bob, is the traditional instrument for disposing of one's estate. A revocable trust has taken on popularity in recent decades as a means of avoiding the probate process. We'll talk perhaps a little later about should you avoid the probate process. But there's pluses and minuses in using a revocable trust as the dispositive instrument. Among the pluses, as we said, avoiding the probate process, asset management, there's a trust in place in the event of disability. The mechanism is there so that assets go on managed without interruption. Some people like to avoid the public record that exists of a will. If the assets are disposed of through a revocable trust, very little comes into the public eye. And lastly, with a revocable trust, because the assets are already in that trust, it may be harder for family members who aren't happy with the disposition to challenge the document.
What is a revocable versus a, is it irrevocable? What's the
it's
difference?
It's like Caribbean and Caribbean. Revocable or revocable can be pronounced both ways.
Okay. But one you can't, one you can, right?
That's exactly right. A revocable trust, as long as you are alive and mentally competent, you can make changes. If it's irrevocable, you cannot make changes. In some cases, for example, where you use an irrevocable trust to pay the insurance premium to keep life insurance out of the estate, you may cease to pay the premiums and effectively terminate the trust, but you can't modify it.
Would somebody, I won't say young in their teens, but let's say mid-career types, 35, 40, and maybe they're not sure what they want to do, but they think they are, and they do irrevocable, and they go, whoops, I changed my mind 10 years later. Maybe there was a marriage, maybe there wasn't. Maybe there was a good friend, maybe there wasn't. Maybe there were siblings, maybe... Then when maybe we get set in our ways later on and we reverse it and do the one that you can't change.
Right.
Maybe we're a little flaky. Maybe I'm a little flaky when I get older. Maybe I'm flaky now. But the point being is, if I do something and then I press that button, can somebody challenge it that I wasn't thinking properly?
They can. First of all, inherently are there two questions, I think, in what you've just said. One is... typically, for example, even if somebody, and we'll come back to this, if somebody chooses for the reasons Dave noted about minimizing probate, disability, and potentially privacy issues, that somebody might use a revocable trust. Commonly, they might use an irrevocable trust to keep life insurance outside their taxable estate. Now, later on, when we're sort of talking about the before and after here, when you said somebody might question it, there's always the piece that, you know, we do the estate planning and then we do the estate and trust administration. If suddenly, because of Dave's, you know, millions and millions, of course, you know, that the family doesn't know about that. But if one of the kids wanted to question it, that he wanted to leave everything to one son and the other son wasn't so happy about that, two common ways to do that are through what's called the undue influence. Think he did that one son suck up to him too much or something. The other one is called question about testamentary capacity. Was there an issue of somebody's mental capacity, which usually is not that high level a degree. It's getting a sense of who you want assets to go to. And do you have a sense of what your assets are? It's not like knowing all the capitals of every state and all that. So, but it can be questioned later, and irrevocable can also be undone that way too.
Does that require a court challenge?
Typically, it would, for somebody to go in, and we handle a lot of these in the firm, and both Dave and I have had the opportunity or the burden to serve. You know, to do some witnessing on these kinds of cases. If Dave's son is, this is really terrible to talk about this so personally, but I don't think he would do this, but if his son did question how much went to the other son, normally the burden is going to be against him. The assumption is that when that will is presented, or that revocable trust, as the case may be, is presented, it's assumed that it is valid, that the person knew what they were doing, and it's a pretty heavy burden. And we've got some, I've watched some of our litigators have to go after people or defend, as the case may be, whether somebody had the capacity to know what they were doing at that time. And it, even if they get flaky later, but at that point in time, did they know what they were doing when the document was signed and the assets were funded into the trust or will?
So you all, as attorneys, meeting with somebody, do you ever challenge them to say, do you really want to do this, if you kind of sniff that it isn't in their best interest to do this?
The more years I've been in practice, the better I believe I've become at not only hearing what a client says, but also hearing what a client hasn't said. And I've also dealt with repercussions of similar decisions made by other people. So if a client does something that I know is likely to bring a challenge or a question or perhaps just a feel bad effect on one of his children or grandchildren, I just ask him again, is this what you really want to do? And be sure that he or she is of a particular mindset. But a will or a revocable trust really reflects what the person wants. They earn the money, they acquired the money or other assets. It is their choice. We are just there as counselors to advise and guide and document.
And if I can add two other things to what Dave has noted, is that, Bob, it's very interesting that a lot of times when the daughter, the child, brings mom and says, mom wants to sign a new will and mom wants to leave everything to me. Well, aside from, as Dave has noted, the bells are going off in your head, we first of all make sure that that daughter, or for that matter, all children and other family members are not in the room when we're going to have the meeting with mom. And we're going to try to get a sense with mom what's needed. There's also a question about if there's undue influence or capacity. Is it best maybe to get a doctor to sign something saying, whether it's the geriatric psychiatrist, the internist that known the person for 30 years, that they did have a sense of, again, their assets and the objects of their bounty, who they want things to receive by, and whether it's even having somebody to be taped to get a sense of, did they know what they're doing? Some of our litigators have suggested you shouldn't do that, because saying, well, why did you tape it, or why did you have the doctor sign this if you had a question in the first place? Doesn't that suggest the reverse, that you were questioning whether the person had it? So there's feelings both ways.
Let me ask you maybe an odd question. Has there ever been a challenge to an attorney by an heir that was not an heir because they were cut out by saying, well, you didn't ask the right questions when you crafted the document?
I think there's certain laws and cases, and it depends on the state. For example, we handle cases in all three of the local jurisdictions. Our primary office is in Maryland. And in Maryland, there's actually a case right on point that talks about privity. So, for example, if an heir, a beneficiary, said, no, I know that dad really wanted me to get more, or you did some mistake in here, can they go after, for example, malpractice against the attorney? And generally, Maryland has said, no, this is between the client and the attorney. And I think on public policy, saying, trying to get a beneficiary to twist it differently is normally restricted to very minor situations, because the client was was dad, for that matter. It was not the ultimate beneficiary.
Some people listening probably have parents that never had a will before, and maybe they aren't now as sharp as they once were. So they come in to see y'all, and they bring in dad or mom, and is that a recipe for disaster? I mean, because if it was just the individual, I want to give everything to the waiter or waitress that I had breakfast with this morning. And they go, no, you know, what about your grandchildren or children or friends? And
well, there's nothing wrong in principle, Bob, with a child bringing a parent or bringing parents in to meet with counsel. Where it can cause an issue would be if there are multiple children and that child gets favored in the dispositive instrument. So if the end result is a will dividing the estate equally among the children, no issue. But if there is some favoritism, that is, as Steve noted, you want to get the child out of the room and be careful that this is, in fact, the disposition that the parent intended and is not under the influence of the one child.
All right, great. This is good stuff. Now, can I get off of that point a little bit? And let's this word probate. What is probate? And people, you know, I don't want this to go to probate, or I don't care if this goes to probate. What would be the good reason to have probate, and what would be the other reason?
I think that's a key question, Bob, and I'll tell you why. A lot of times we get clients in, and one of the first things they say to us is, I know I need to avoid probate. And I usually will say to them, and do you know what probate is? And they said, not a clue, but I know I need to avoid it. Because every piece of paper, three or four times a week, we get letters across in our mailbox saying avoid probate. Probate, which is is simply the process by which assets are controlled by a will. In most of the local jurisdictions, they go to a register of will. In Virginia, they're done reviewed by the commissioner of accounts through the clerk. But the fact is, the probate process is the one where assets are controlled by a will. So if, for example, if there are assets like life insurance where you have a beneficiary designation, or an IRA, or a TSP, that thrift savings plan document, or even a joint account, those are examples by which the will has nothing to do with it. And we'll get more into some further examples. But where the will, you own something, and there is no designation, no survivorship piece, and the will is going to control it. Therefore, the will takes over. And the probate is simply the process by which you have to file quite a few papers, to get the assets taken care of. And whether the person is called a personal representative or executor, it's just pretty much all the same in the local jurisdictions. And that's the process by way you ultimately dispose of the property. You make sure it's transferred. And in our system, in my mind, I don't know if Dave disagrees, but one of the main reasons I think probate was set up is to make sure, which is counterintuitive, is that creditors are protected. In a way, creditors have priority over beneficiaries. Creditors can also include the IRS. Or the state or DC governments, to make sure that they're taken care of before what's ever left over is ultimately distributed on to the beneficiaries through a series of paperwork and filings.
Okay, let me profile who's listening, which I think you know because you deal a lot with feds, but they have this great thing called an annuity. It really has no cash value upon their passing. If there's a survivor's annuity, they get it. But the last one goes, it's gone. But they do have a chunk of change generally in their thrift savings plan. They may or may not have anything near that in their IRA, but they may transfer the thrift savings plan over to the IRA. And you help me here. I think there was something not long ago, whether it was a week or a month ago, where creditors could get at an inherited IRA.
All right.
And would that also apply to the thrift?
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled, about 6 weeks ago, that inherited IRAs are not retirement plans in the hands of the recipient, because the recipient has the ability to cash it. The funds may be used for non-retirement purposes, and it is reachable by creditors. The court did not deal with the issue in regard to other types of plans. Generally, they are protected from creditors, but in the context of an inheritance, the decision of the Supreme Court leaves open the issue as to whether it might be applied to other types of retirement plans as well.
Okay, so with regard to the thrift is an interesting beast. It can accept money from an IRA that the taxable portion of the IRA can be transferred in at any age. Or the reverse can hold true. The thrift can transfer money into a traditional IRA. a little bit more of a definition of that. But if it could go backwards and forward, at the end of the day, when the person passes, whether they have a thrift or whether they have an IRA or whether they move the IRA into the thrift, it's still going to go to somebody, and most likely it's then going to go into an inherited IRA. So we got the same issue. So if they inherit an IRA, it doesn't make any difference whether it came out of the thrift.
Exactly. That's a repercussion of the change in the law a half dozen years ago or so that essentially allows rollovers in almost any direction from one type of qualified plan, IRA, TSA, 401k, 403b, into any other type of plan. At some point, it's almost hopelessly commingled.
Right. And there's inherently three pieces to what you've asked, Bob. One is that if it is an IRA or TSP, you're generally got more of an asset protection. So if you punch somebody in a bar, hopefully no federal employee, government worker would do
this. They don't go to bars, but they do go to sporting events.
To sporting events. Okay. They didn't like the World Cup result. So in that situation, almost always an IRA is, or a TSP or the non-government approach, the 401k, are all going to be pretty much, with a few exceptions, protected from that. Number two is the piece that we talked about a few minutes ago, is because each of those has a beneficiary designation, they will generally avoid probate as well, so that they generally are not going to be subject to the supervision of the local courts. The other piece, though, that there's a distinction between for estate tax, which we'll get into, I believe, in a few minutes, is that it is possible that even though there's a second kind of estate, there's the probate estate and there's the taxable estate. So even though it does not go to this court supervision or the register of wills, the fact that you still have a benefit, it's almost always going to be part of your taxable estate. With the exception of if you're the survivor of the spouses and essentially it dies with you, that annuity, then there's really nothing to pass on to other people. So therefore, that's not going to be part of your taxable estate. However, if you die with the TSP or an IRA, that is part of your taxable estate, even though it's not part of your probate estate.
Okay. What if I have an issue, a special needs person? Or I have a person that maybe isn't so good with money, and I want to leave my TSP and or my IRA, but can I make it creditor proof in that case?
Generally, you can. What one normally would put into there is you would feed it into what's called a supplemental needs trust or a special needs trust. In the local jurisdictions, it may sound obvious with these words, but two kinds of trusts are, one's called a support trust, the other one's called discretionary. A supplemental needs or special needs is taking a discretionary trust and putting it a little bit on steroids. It's saying, I want the trustee to have absolute control. So you'd never want to say income comes out automatically. You'd pretty much never let the beneficiary be able to demand it, because creditors would be able to reach it too. So if we've got that special needs child that we want to make sure that government assistance might be available to them, to him or to her, we want to make sure that the trustee is empowered with a tremendous amount of discretion, using terms like that they can use it for the happiness, the comfort. You don't want to say for the support or maintenance, because otherwise the creditor might be able to reach it and step into the shoes of the beneficiary a little bit easier. And even with, for example, a TSP plan or an IRA, if those monies are fed into the plan, again, you want to give it to the discretion of sort of a third-party trustee, to give a lot of power and, again, not permit the beneficiary to control it.
Bob, one very important point that this last discussion has lent itself to: it is extremely important that you do not make the estate the beneficiary of a retirement plan. You make individuals, you make certain trusts the beneficiary, but there are two major, major issues if you make the estate the beneficiary of your retirement plan, and in some cases, if you fail to designate, some plans may default to the estate. The first issue is you're making the retirement plan subject to creditors of the estate. Several years ago, I worked with an unfortunate situation of an individual who died suddenly. He owed the IRS over $500,000. The estate would have been insolvent, but the beneficiary of $1 million plus in life insurance was the estate. And the second reason why you don't make the estate the beneficiary, if you have a TSA or other retirement plan and you have not reached the required beginning date, generally age 70 and a half, is that if the estate is named the beneficiary, you must get all assets out of the plan or IRA within a five-year period. An estate cannot be a designated beneficiary, and where the beneficiaries can enjoy taking monies out over time and enjoying the benefit of compound growth.
Great. I'm going to take this off on a teeny tangent, but we're not going to spend much time there. I know there's a group of people that listen to the show. One is really writes us good questions and whatnot, but he is in a community property state. So somebody that's in a community property state, do they need special attention relative to what we're doing? Don't have to explain why. It's just kind of a yes or no, so that they're not sitting there saying, okay, this applies to me.
Community property, which tends to be, I can't remember, it's somewhere between 9 and 11 states that are community property. They're mostly towards the western part of the United States, with the exception of Wisconsin. those are very, very different rules than the people with who are in common law states. A lot of the common law states will respect, for example, Maryland has a new law. Virginia specifically says you must respect property that's community property. But the people that are in community property, it's a very different world. And for example, in California and probably Texas too, you almost always would use a joint trust because of some income tax basis items. Whereas common law states tend to use revocable trusts, one for each spouse more commonly.
Perfect. I never use anybody's name, but if he's listening, that's for you. And he spreads the word. Very good with that. Anyway, let's come back. We've built on some words, so let's see if we can put them together. Can the probate process that we talked about be avoided without using a revocable trust?
Well, we've already alluded to some alternative ways of avoiding the probate process without using a revocable trust. Beneficiary designation. On retirement plans and life insurance, you can designate a primary beneficiary and a contingent beneficiary. On bank and brokerage accounts, you may make those accounts payable on death, transferable on death to one or more individuals. Because you have a designated beneficiary, you avoid the probate process. And of course, having a family member's name on an account with right of survivorship avoids the probate process as well. Now, if it is children as opposed to a spouse, that raises some special issues, and even in the case of a spouse, there can be some fairly complex tax reasons, particularly in the case of bank and brokerage accounts, why you may not want those accounts to be joint with the right of survivorship.
Let me add one more thing, because assuming that most people listening to this show have some kind of direct deposit from their federal payments in some ways, whether it's from their annuity, from the TSP, whatever, it is very difficult to go back and to change the title of that account to, as remember Dave mentioned, you want to use a revocable trust. And in that situation, it's difficult to have that account changed and go back to all the payors and said, please now transfer it, pay it to my revocable trust. One way to avoid that is to use an approach where, let's say you have a revocable trust, but if the direct deposit says, I'm going to have X person, Sam, over here, be my power of attorney, but on my death, rather than changing the title of that bank account that's got the direct deposit, they could add, as Dave noted, add a pay on death, a POD. And it's confusing because there's a POA, which stands for power of attorney, and a POD, which stands for pay on death. And those are very separate concepts, but it could be paid on death directly to the trust rather than even an individual, and you end up getting to the same place. It runs through the revocable trust, and you're back to the big three, minimizing probate, disability issues, and retaining the privacy perspective.
Okay. Everybody isn't married, and you go, yeah, I know that. So if somebody is unmarried, let's say mid-career, late mid-career, pre-retirement, a little bit post-retirement, and they may have children, they may have friends, they may have cousins. Is it good for them to hold property jointly, this person, to hold property jointly with that child, or let's say there are no children, with a good friend, one named Dave, one named Steve?
Well, the problem in holding property jointly with your children, you are putting the asset at risk if the child has a creditor. Parents don't always know if their child has any issues with IRS, for example, and a child could get into an automobile accident, and if it's catastrophic, there could be exposure beyond the amount of insurance coverage. It puts the parents' assets at risk. And we discourage in almost all cases a parent titling property with a child, one or more children. An exception might be a modest checking or savings account that could be utilized by the child to handle funeral expenses in the event of a sudden death, but you don't put any real wealth in a joint account with a child.
Yeah, and I want to add a couple other things, which are, one is, if you compare that situation, and let's say the single person has two children, in the situation where, aside from the creditor aspect, there's the piece, and sometimes we would refer to this as people that used joint accounts for pretty much everything is the poor man's will. And we meant it not so much of as an economic perspective, from the fact that it's shortcutting things, that it may end up being an unequal distribution. If everything is placed with one child, the more mature child thinking they'll take care of it, there's always an issue. Well, was this done for convenience and they'll equalize later? Or was it done for the sense of saying, no, I really want this child to get more? And that can be a problem. By using a revocable trust, you can not only cover the equalization, the protection against what Dave noted as potential creditors of the child, but you can also cover other factors. What if that child does not survive? Maybe you want to go on to that child's children, what some people refer to as issue prosterpes, letting it carry on to the next generation. And it covers a lot more factors and permutations.
Okay, we've covered some really good topics here. But if I'm lost, how do I get in touch with you two?
Well, we are both partners at the Rockville, Maryland law firm of Stein Sperling. Our main phone number is 301-340-2020.
Okay, very good. What's the difference between joint tenants with right of survivorship and tenants by the entirety?
Actually, there's a related one, Bob, that people confuse. People should be aware there's essentially three kinds of tenancies. The most obvious one people are familiar with is the joint tenants with right of survivorship. Sometimes they'll see on their bank accounts two names and it says JTWROS. I think I got all those letters out. And that simply means that if I've named somebody as a joint tenant with right of survivorship, upon my death, it automatically goes to that person. Not only does it avoid probate, but it basically said, and if I've named you, Bob, as the other joint tenant with that bank account, aside from the fact that my wife's not going to be very happy because she just lost that asset, no matter what the will says, there's the fact that it does avoid probate. Now, the second kind of tenancy is a form of joint tenancy with two differences. It's called tenants by the entirety. And tenants by the entirety, the first difference, and it is a form of joint tenancy, but the first difference is it must be husband and wife. Nobody else can be on it, just husband and wife. And most states and the local jurisdictions have very strong tenants by the entirety statutes. Some states, like Colorado, don't recognize it as well. But tenants by the entirety said, now is it husband and wife, but it is considered a unit. So that if, with the exception of the IRS, and I'm going to turn to Dave on this one in a minute, with the exception of the IRS, generally, if there's a creditor of one of the spouses, they still cannot reach it unless the creditor is a creditor of both spouses.
The IRS is the only exception to that, per a U.S. Supreme Court decision in Kraft versus United States about a dozen years ago. IRS can reach tenants by the entirety's account, and it must preserve 50% for the spouse who does not owe taxes, assuming it's the liability of only one of the two.
Wasn't Robert Kraft by any chance, was it?
No, not Robert Kraft.
Okay.
And the third kind of tenancy, just to close the loop, is sometimes referred to as a TIC account, which stands for tenancy in common. And if the three of us own something as tenants in common, and I looked it up, I don't think there's such a word, but is each of us has an interest that is willable. We can, whether it's owned by a will or it's owned by a trust, then it is, it can be controlled and I can direct where my interest goes. There is not an automatic survivorship interest to it.
Great. Thanks.
I might add, Bob, since we were talking about tenants by the entirety, as more and more states recognize same-sex marriage, that couples who are legally married and are of the same sex may title assets as tenants by the entirety, and those who previously had assets as joint tenants with right of survivorship in most of these jurisdictions will need to retitle their assets as tenants by the entirety to enjoy the general protection against creditors.
Thank you. And we have a caller.
Sure. I appreciate your show. It's very informative. My wife and I had a revocable trust prepared in 2008 by a certified elder law attorney. Since then, two other law firms have reviewed it and stated that it is inadequate. How do I know which attorney is correct?
That's a great question.
I know the answer.
Well, I think that anytime you have more than one attorney, they're always going to say, it needs review by something else. I think that it's hard to know. I don't know. I think one attorney, as I say, can always question whether another attorney has done something correctly. But I don't know how you'd actually get that until one of us saw it. I mean, I can't tell. Maybe the first one is fine, and it's a judgment call. We need to see it.
Keep in mind that sometimes there are differences of professional judgment. There is no one way that is necessarily right or wrong in many areas, including whether to use a will or a revocable trust. In determining which estate planning attorney to utilize, you should check his professional background, and all of that is available on the internet. And then it comes down to who do you trust the most? And if you're getting contradictory advice, bring the alternative recommendation or the alternative interpretation of the law to each of them and have them explain the alternative away if they can.
And it might be worth getting it in writing, at least possibly by the second and third attorneys, just to say what is the concern, and bringing it to one, if not the other, or both of them, saying, how do you describe this? And I sure agree with Dave that there's a lot of judgment calls with the planning approach, but I would try to get in writing about why they might feel it's inadequate.
Okay, and I'll have to put a plug in. Tammy Flanagan, I'm sure the audience knows who Tammy is. Tammy's GovExec columnist weekly. She's the senior benefit director of NITP, co-host of the radio show, and she's going to do a webinar. I'll be the moderator, and Tammy will be doing a show, and it's pretty good. There's no charge for this. I'll give you the call letters to sign up, and it's federal benefits. You don't know what you don't know. Sounds like a commercial, doesn't it? But we don't sell anything, but it sounds like one of those commercials. Federal benefits, you don't, and we're going to talk about just normal things that somebody might not be aware of. And in order to sign up for the webinar, go to NITPINC.com. NITPINC.com. For those of you that don't know, NITP is the company that does this show. And we do pre-retirement, mid-career seminars in D.C., outside of D.C., and even outside the United States. And we've been doing it for 30-plus years. So I think you check this out. We're going to do it monthly starting Thursday, 2 o'clock Eastern Time, and we're going to run an hour. Again, NITPINC.com. All righty. Sorry, guys, but this is our launch. We've done other ones, but we've never done a monthly series, and we're gonna start doing it. All righty. Where were we? Who should be the beneficiary of your retirement plans? Again, with this one retirement plan with the feds, the newer federal employee, the quote one, somebody covered under FERS, generally has a lot more money in this TSP, which is effectively a 401k, but it's not a 401k, than they do an IRA. So who do we leave it to, and how do we know who best to leave it to?
In general, if you're married and it is not a second marriage where the intention is each providing for children from a prior marriage, in general, you're going to want to name your spouse as primary beneficiary of any retirement plan, because only the spouse has an ability to roll over and to maximize the time period over which distributions will be made. There are, if you want to leave other amounts to children, perhaps, then you leave other assets. But retirement plans are best left up to or best left to the spouse, and often in larger estates, the contingent beneficiary is a trust under which the spouse can say, oops, my estate is too large, there may be estate tax consequences, let me enjoy the income, and then it goes on to the children. In smaller estates, the children directly may be the contingent beneficiary.
And let me add two other factors to that. In most, other than IRAs, as a matter of fact, to name anybody other than the spouse, there must be a waiver. Almost 30 years ago, is it Senator Ferraro? I guess at that time introduced a bill, and it's now known as the Retirement Equity Act, because there was a thinking that people were taking their money out, and the explanation we were all giving was that they were going to go buy trailers in Florida. I'm not sure what the real explanation, but the concern was that spouses were not being protected. So for plans other than IRAs, a spouse generally must consent, and in almost all situations, at least in front of a notary or the plan administrator. One other thing, and Dave and I have kind of talked about this in the past, that there's some people that think that, you know, maybe the couple might want to consider, do they want to name those young grandchildren to get a real long payment? There's always a concern because there's taxable income. It gets very complicated, whereas the spouse can defer it until he or she has reached age of 70 and a half. But whereas if it goes to somebody other than a spouse, they must begin paying out at least in the year following the year of the participant's death.
Okay, with regards to the thrift, years ago when it was first started and until recently, a spouse could be the beneficiary, but they couldn't leave it in the thrift. Now they can. But when that second spouse passes, I think the taxes are fairly ugly to the beneficiaries. So yeah, who knows the answer to how to plan for that, to say if the spouse is in ill health, don't leave it in here.
Well, Bob, it's actually gotten a little bit better because I don't think there's an exception to this, but many people refer to the fact that if it goes to the spouse after the first death, then there's usually a fresh start rule with the spouse. And if the spouse then leaves it to children, so let's say in your example, being a sexist here, the husband dies first, then the wife, or I guess, you know, but let's assume that when the wife dies and she then leaves it to the children, in most situations, they can roll it over to inherited IRAs. I don't think there's a restriction on that coming out of a TSP, but the inherited IRA would permit the child or grandchild or whoever is the beneficiary or the cousin or friend, as the case may be, can then take it out over his or her life expectancy. So it may be, hopefully, it's possibly growing faster than it's actually being taken out.
Okay. We're running tight. This last question. Reported incidents of both family members and outsiders being preyed upon by people. So in other words, if we're sitting here, we could be mid-career, we could be late career, we could be retired. And we're concerned, as we notice this, that these people might not be the best to be in full control of those assets. How do we guard against that?
Well, and this is partly why we're actually thinking estate planning is a little bit of a misnomer. Lifetime planning, as people are living longer, is actually a major consideration. First of all, there's some things that can be taken, and not necessarily any of these are perfect, because we've had some people we thought we did everything, and suddenly they started ordering everything on Shoppers Network as they're sitting at home on TV.
You know my mother, huh?
We know her very well. That's what we said. No, but number one, we might want to consider removing the credit cards. A most stringent option would be to set up a guardianship. That's court supervision, but alternatives might be setting up a power of attorney, both healthcare and financial. And similarly, the guardianship can be set up over the person and the property. You might want to consider letting everybody know about the financial advisors, the accountants, the financial planner, even the banks. You might want to require that accounts suddenly have two signatures required. The fact that the revocable might suddenly turn into an irrevocable trust and try to change the trustees might be relevant too.
And I think that one should pay attention to any late in life unusual relationships that may have just been formed by an elderly family member. Some of them are, of course, innocent, but there are predators out there, to repeat a term that we utilized before, and we have to, as counselors, as attorneys, we need to be on guard for our clients and to put them on guard to protect older family members.
Okay, I think we have to wind it up. Dave, Steve, this is an education for me, and I hope education for the folks listening. Dave's been schooling me for 30-some odd years. We used to work together before then. Anyway, thanks for coming, guys.
A pleasure.
Thanks. It's a real treat.
All righty. Andrew, thanks for taking care of us, and we'll be back next week, same time, same station, and check in with our webinar, please. NITPinc.com, things you don't know that you should. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.